Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Rebecca Cohen Morris. She's a former evangelical Protestant, and she came into the church in 2020. Rebecca, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having
me. Share your story. Your story has a lot of twists and turns. I don't think 20, 30 years ago, you would have seen yourself here sharing your story, that you're Catholic, that you're living in Steubenville, Ohio.
Never would have thought any of that would be possible. I mean, I was born in Manhattan, New York. Mm-hmm. So kind of has taken me on a journey and ended up here. So
Well, praise
really
God.
Glad to be here.
And again, you're in Steubenville now, and you work in the Women's Center there, AIM Ministry. We'll talk a little bit more at the end here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, my husband and I moved there 3 years ago with our two daughters. I was finishing law school and had left a life of politics and teaching and activism. And we've just really loved the community there. And it's really a blessing.
Well, what a blessing. Well, looking forward to talk more about and hear more about that ministry later, but also the way that your story plays into it. You know, you got to, again, a lot of twists and turns that we have to navigate through. So let's go way back to the beginning.
Okay.
Where does your story begin? Where did you grow up? What was your family's faith background?
Yeah. So I feel like if you want to start when you're born, it's only half of the story. So I mean, we're all from a family and parents and their faith journeys. So just briefly, my dad was born. He's 99% Ashkenazi Jew into a very Jewish home in Long Beach, Long Island, New York. And his journey took him all the way to California surfing. And he found himself homeless and hitchhiking. And this pastor picked him up, a Protestant pastor picked him up. And he went and lived with him and his wife for a little while. And my dad found the Lord and gave his life to Jesus and was like, oh, this all makes so much more sense. So that was all happening in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And my mom's from New Zealand, from Christchurch. All her family still lived there. Mm-hmm. So she was raised in a agnostic, atheist home. You know, they were like, go to church. It's good for you. But, you know, go learn some ways to behave and some morals. But she found herself at 15 wandering down the street to a tent revival that her friend had invited her to. And she experienced the Holy Spirit and came to know the Lord. And so 20 years later, my dad's teaching at a Bible college down there, and my mom is the administrative assistant to the headmaster of the school. And my dad was just doing a 9-month teaching stint. He comes there, they meet and marry in 9 months, and he flies her to New York City, where they live and start working for Jews for Jesus. And that's where I was born during that time in their life. So that's where I come in, and we start off in New York City.
All right.
So we spent some time living there. I was only there a couple weeks. My parents have been there a year or two. We moved to North Philly. And it was a place where we could rent something that was affordable. And Philly was expensive even then. And I have really good memories there. You know, it was we were the only white people on the street. And everyone else was mostly black. And, you know, we had block parties. And, you know, I never understood anything about discrimination or anything like it. We just felt like we were embraced by the community. But 6 years later, after we decided to move to Georgia to, you know, get some, you know, we could own a house for the same price we were renting and have some land. So we moved to Georgia, and our neighborhood was, you know, very, very white, and there was not a lot of diversity racially. And we actually experienced a lot of discrimination. You know, people would shoot our house and steal our mail and burn it. They didn't like that my dad was Jewish. They didn't like my mom was an immigrant. They didn't like we were Yankees. So we'd moved into the South in rural Georgia, and, you know, trash dump was across the street, the chicken farm and the cow pasture. And it was very strange to me. I was observing, even as a 6 or 7 year old, like, this was, you know, I was learning about how history had gone. And I was like, this is just very strange. Like, I don't feel accepted here with the people in the neighborhood. And it was just, you know, definitely a formative moment in my life.
Yeah.
So, my parents were raising us in the Assemblies of God church. When we moved to the South, we joined an interdenominational church. It was very, charismatic, and the people were really good there. And so that's kind of how we started off. And that's really where, when we moved to the South, I feel like my life, you know, I had some of the more traumatic things in my life that happened, a lot of, you know, abuse, physical, sexual, just all of it. And it, you know, I very much remember thinking like, if there is a God, he hates me. But it's also likely there's no God. So I didn't know which one was worse, to believe that there was one that thought I was not worth protecting. I'd go to school and I was very awkward. So I've been about this tall since I was 12. I'm 5'9". So in the second grade, I was like, you know, 7, and I was taller than my teacher. My mom made all my clothes. We didn't have a lot of money. People did not appreciate homemade clothes like they do, like now in the modern hipster era.
Now it's chic.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You're like, oh, I made this. And you're like, oh my gosh, where'd you get the fabric? Yeah. My friends were convinced my mom was making my clothes out of curtains. I found a note someone wrote about me like, oh, she's just, her mom makes her clothes out of curtains. Like, you know, I had big, big glasses, big fluffy hair, homemade clothes, taller than everyone. You know, one or two pairs of shoes, like, so I just to give you the pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't really find myself fitting in at school. And, my dad had, lost his job at, where he was working. So it ended up that he was going to have to be out of town all the time. So he was out of town 4 or 5 days of some weeks, 3 or 4 nights, some weeks. And we were really struggling financially. There's my brother and my sister, that we're all within 3.5 years of each other. And so my mom's working full time. My dad's gone all the time. And we're really struggling financially. So, my mom had no friends really in Georgia. We lived out in the middle of nowhere. All her family was in New Zealand. Her mom had passed away. And she just didn't really, I think she fell into like a pretty deep depression and not even knowing that that was what it was.
Right.
Being at home was difficult. Being at school was difficult. Being at church, you know, there was I still remember these two older people that would, you know, they'd be like, God has a plan for you and he loves you. And I was like, I don't know, maybe. But every time I got my hopes up, something else bad would happen. I'd go to a church camp or something bad would happen. Some guy would do something to me. And I would try to figure out how to deal with it. But all the different people I went to were like, well, I'm sure they didn't mean to communicate this, but I heard it's your fault that this is happening. Mm-hmm. And so those were the only kind of like personal attention I felt like I was getting. Mm-hmm. So that was really difficult for me, being in that, feeling very alone.
Yeah.
But I always had, my mom told me, when I was about 3, this missionary from India had come to the church, and that I was sitting there, and she said I was just entranced and just really focused on what she was saying. And so I always had this heart for, like, I want to help people. Like, if there are people in need, you know, this woman was talking about how she worked, you know, around the trash dumps in southern India and working with the kids. And I was like, that's what I want to do. Like, I my first book I ever checked out of the library was about India. And I was like, I'm going to India. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go live in the trash pile. I'm going to work with the kids. I'm going to just throw my life into serving other people.
Yeah.
So even with all the, you know, it wasn't like all bleak, like God really had, there was always this seed of hope.
Sure.
That like God loved me, or there was something good, even if I didn't realize it was God that drew me to serving others and showing love.
Yeah.
By the time I was 12, I was very confused with life in general. You know, a lot of the bullying and the abuse and feeling alone just became too much. So I was trying to work my way up to just committing suicide.
Mm.
And so I would like take pills and try to like get the gall up to just overdose. And, you know, I was convinced no one would really care too much. I'd run away from home a couple times, and it was just, I just really was very, very lost. So I made this deal with God. So I said, you know, if you're real, you can show up by the end of the summer. I like how we think we make ultimatums with God, but I made, you know, you either show up by the end of the summer. If you don't, then I'm going to do it. And there's just no, I just can't live any longer. I just am in so much pain. Mm. So I go to a church camp and they were like, you know, come up and pray if you want to be prayed for. And I was like, I mean, I've been up to the altar 1,000 times at Protestant churches. I think I got saved, you know, at least 6 or 7 times because I was like, I don't want to die and go to hell. Like, I don't know if I'm really saved, you know. So I go up to the altar and I'm like, I didn't even tell the lady what to pray for. She just, this woman, I don't know who she was. She just put her hands on me and she started praying for me. And I felt like electricity go through my body. And I very clearly heard God say, everything that has happened to you, I'm going to use it for good. Just hold on. Like, it's going to be okay. I have a reason for this and I have a reason for your life. And that was all I needed. Like, it was so, so transformative. Yeah. You know, I could look back at that time, even when I would go into, you know, other parts of my life where I wasn't glorifying the Lord. Mm-hmm. That would always be a big moment where I was like, did I manufacture that? I don't know. Like, it seemed pretty real that God was saying that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That was around 12.
That was when I was 12. Yeah. Right. So that's about when it was 1999, right before, you know, Y2K and all that.
Gotcha. All right. What happened next?
So, you know, I go through high school. I end up going on a mission trip to Peru that next year. So I was with Trinity Christian Fellowship. It was my church, you know, a lot of love for them and a lot of really good people. So we were going down to a church in Peru and my parents let me go. And they were like, you just have to make sure you room with this other lady. And she was gracious enough to let me room with her in this hotel. And, you know, we fly into Lima. I don't speak any Spanish. You know, I had like Spanish in first grade. And, you know, I knew like the colors, the alphabet.
Yeah.
So I get to Peru and I'm like, I just hate that I can't communicate. And like, there were one or two girls in our group that could speak Spanish. And I was like, what are they saying? What are they saying? And just trying to soak it all up. And every night we would have a sermon. It would be in English. It would be in Spanish. They would translate one sentence after the other. So this was like, it'll make more sense later on in the story. But I really just, I hated not being able to communicate with people when they would give us food that, you know, they were living like we were outside of Lima in Chincha Alta and people lived in, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, stick huts with a newspaper ceiling that would fall in when it rained and then they'd rebuild it. And they had all this food for us, this like American church that's coming there. We're helping like, you know, work with their students. We were doing some skits, you know, had preachers come in helping them fix things up in the church. But they just gave us everything that they could. And I hated only being able to say, gracias. So I just really, I feel like God allowed me to have that experience to kind of, you know, it planted that seed again. You know, yeah. I had always wanted to do some kind of mission. So I loved it. It was a great experience. And with that and the summer experience, I went into high school and, you know, a lot of the kids we'd grown up with on the street, there were a lot of drugs, you know, there was a lot of alcoholism, there was a lot of abuse. So like a lot of kids get tempted by certain things in high school, but I was like, there's nothing glamorous about it. Right. Like I've been into, you know, the girl down the street where her dad's passed out on the couch drunk and her mom's outside smoking weed and they're cussing and, you know, beating their kids. And and the people who were doing meth next door. And the people who were doing pills on the other side, and you're like, you know, their kids had been taken away. The state, the police were there. You know, it was just, there wasn't anything glamorous about that life.
Right.
So when I had friends, so we were at a Christian school. It was a Baptist school. So I had like my interdenominational church. We did all the Passovers and Hanukkah and all that. So we still were very much like in our messianic part
family.
Of our faith. Yeah, in our family. Yeah. My mom had really embraced it, you know, even coming from New Zealand, not being Jewish at all. She was like, I'm going to make the best matzo ball soup you ever tasted. You know, we're going to do Hanukkah every year, Yom Kippur, like all of it, Purim. So we had that going on at home. I was at a Baptist school. in the high school, you know, a lot of the kids had a lot of, it wasn't like a super wealthy school. I was kind of there on like a bit of a scholarship, or, you know, they helped us out with money to go to the school. So a lot of the kids had, you know, their parents were buying them new cars, you know, they would babysit for someone, two kids just watching TV, they'd get paid $100. I'd be babysitting five kids, get paid $20. I'm like, I was like, oh, I need to make these connections, you know? But yeah, so I was in school and, you know, the kids were, I mean, not nominally, I mean, they're kids, they're in high school. But a lot of my friends started struggling with alcohol, drugs, sex, you know, just all the stuff. And, you know, I was always going to youth group and all of that, but, they were like, I don't feel like you judge me. So I would, people would call me when they were in a bad situation. So I was like the girl who'd be at the parties, but like would help people out, or I would come and get people. And so, you know, I felt like I was in a pretty good place, and I was like, okay, all that bad stuff that happened, like people would come to me when something like that had happened. And I was feeling like God was using this, but, you know, high school goes on, you get to college. I started to, you know, we were taught like, you know, you had to believe everything in the Bible literally, you know, literal 7-day creation, you know, sola scriptura, everything. Like if you can't reconcile it in the Bible, like you better find some other way to reconcile it because that's all there is. Right. So I was having a hard time with the ideas of, you know, evolution. I was like, every time I read the science books, I seem like I have to either like give up my faith or believe, or just say I don't believe science, or that I don't believe that, you know, evolution. You know, it was just very confusing. And I was thinking in very black and white terms, you know, where it was just like evolution, no God, literal creation, God. Yeah. And if you believe one, then you can't believe the other. And,
yeah, sort of an all or nothing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I would ask my professors, I was reading all of, you know, trying to really understand.
Where was this at?
So I went to Southeastern University. Okay. So I skipped. You got to do that. So, you know, and I guess kind of going a little bit back. So I started playing sports. I realized in like fifth grade, and that was kind of a turning point, that I was actually really good at basketball. And so they were like, well, you kind of look like a scarecrow, but you're pretty good at basketball. So we'll have you on the team. And I started doing really well in fifth grade, sixth grade. So I played sports, ended up, we had at our private school, if you were seventh and eighth grade and you were good enough, you could play a little bit on the varsity. I didn't get to play a lot of varsity because I was doing my bat mitzvah when I was studying for that when I was 13. So all the games were on Tuesdays and Saturdays and Fridays, but I missed the Tuesday games and the Saturday games because I was going to the synagogue to learn Hebrew and, you know, do my bat mitzvah. My dad had been starting his bar mitzvah, but his parents got divorced. His dad was kind of I didn't believe this was a thing, but he was like a part of like the Russian Jewish mafia. So like he came from all this, kind of back in the day. So that was his family. His dad left his mom. There was a lot of infidelity. It was a rough time for my dad. So he wasn't able to finish his bar mitzvah. So I was like, you know, as homage to my father, I was like, I want to do this. You know, my brother and sister weren't interested in doing it, but I was like, I'm going to do this for dad. And, that was a special time too. Yeah. We spent a long time in traffic, in Atlanta traffic, driving to Beth Hillel, driving back. And, I had this like sports versus faith, but I was like, you know, you only get one dad, you only get one chance to do a bar mitzvah at this age. So, you know, I'll put sports on the back burner, but I ended up being really good. So I get my bat mitzvah, my whole basketball team comes and they're just like trying to figure out the books. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. So my brother was the DJ. I think he was playing Who Let the Dogs Out on my boombox. I think one of my aunts dropped a bagel and cussed in front of the rabbi. It was just great. It was a great time. I got a new dress from Walmart, like for the bat mitzvah. So I was really living my best life.
So
I play high school basketball and all that after my bat mitzvah. This is getting to where I was at college.
Yeah.
So I couldn't play a lot varsity, so I worked really hard. And I was like, I'm going to be on varsity. I hate sitting on the bench. So we won the state championship in ninth grade. I got MVP. I was obviously a post because I was really tall. 10th grade, we won. I was MVP. 11th grade, we lost by 1 point in the final. Wow. We ended our undefeated streak in a blaze of sadness, and I shed one tear. I didn't ever cry after games, mostly because we won, but I also was like, I don't want to cry. But I definitely shed a couple tears after that loss at the state championship. And then my senior year, they put it where we had to decide between whether we went on the senior trip to London or you played in the state championship. They had accidentally scheduled them on top of each other. Oof. So at 17, I'm like, okay, I'm a captain. Looks like, and we'd moved up to a new division. And they thought we just aren't, they're not going to be that good. Like, it won't matter if we schedule the trip over it. So I was like, I feel like we're doing really well this season. I think we're going to make it to the finals. So I had saved up money to go on this trip. And I ended up having to like cancel it, and I stayed to play in the final four. We lost, but we got third in the state, and it was no regrets. I took that money from the trip, and I put it on a new car. And when everyone came back home, I'd bought my own car. That was an upgrade from the $500 car I'd bought from my neighbor the a few years before. So everyone else, their parents had bought their car for them, but I, for better or worse, I had to buy my own car, and I felt such pride. Yeah. So I played basketball. It was great. It was really a great opportunity for me to kind of emerge from my nerdery as a child.
Well, and have a place of mastery, something that you had control over that you could be confident at. That gives a lot of confidence.
Totally. And I was like, so I was very. I think you touched on something where I was very performance based, and it was like, if I just live my life right, if I do really well in these things, get good grades, do well in basketball, don't mess up too much, don't drink, don't do all the things in high school that a lot of kids are doing, then things are gonna go well for you. And I didn't think everything was going to have to be perfect, but I was like, if you live your life a certain way, God is going to work it out. And God works all things together for good to those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So I was like, well, maybe I won't get everything I want, but life's probably going to go well for me. So anyway, go to freshman year. I just I don't think I'm going to play basketball. I've been practicing 3.5 hours a day for the last 4 years. I'm going to take off. So I went to Lee University. I got a full ride that first year, and I was like, I'll just go there and it'll be free. They charge you tuition the next year. So I was like, I don't know if I want to stay here. I was working in college. I was taking classes, having to pay for everything, again, my family, my dad, after he'd left Jews for Jesus, he started, his own leather repair business. So my dad fixed furniture, and my mom, sometimes she taught, and then sometimes she ran the office for my dad as a secretary. So, so I was paying for everything, I get sick, got to go to the doctor. Obviously I could ask my parents, but they were always struggling with money, and I just felt bad anytime. So I was having to make it on my own. I felt like, at 18, in college at Lee, working at Logan's Roadhouse, I think the only food I ate that wasn't in the cafeteria were the buns that, you get the rolls at Logan's, and the peanuts, So that was, that was my freshman year, and I decided, I think I'm going to – I miss basketball. I was also seeing at the school – so it was a Church of God school. So, again, I was trying to make sure I touched on all the different denominations, but it was nothing necessarily about that denomination. But what I noticed was a lot of the kids in the parties that we would be at on Friday and Saturday nights, they would be there – not acting like they were acting when they were leading worship at chapel, during the week. And they would be, decrying kids who are going out and getting drunk and having sex. And I was like, I literally have seen you doing this every time we've been out. So that started, I never liked hypocrisy, but it really started to rub me the wrong way. I also started to miss basketball, and Southeastern University, which was an Assemblies of God college where Mark Rutland was the president. And I have a very special place in my heart for him and his heart. They were like, we're still recruiting you. Do you want to come? And I was like, all right, I'll go to Florida. You know, so I left Tennessee, moved to Florida. You know, my parents are like, we're going to help you pay for college. We'll pay half, you pay half. So I'm taking out like, you know, $70,000 of student loans over the next few years. Yeah. And I'm choosing to be an English major, which is obviously what you should do when you're $70,000 in debt.
Yeah.
But I was getting to play basketball. And that was really one of the biggest reasons I was there. And I also thought, you know, at Southeastern, it seems like the kids I was meeting there, they seemed very genuine in their faith. There wasn't I'm a hypocrite too sometimes, but it didn't seem as, like in my mind, I was like, it's going to be more authentic there. Mm-hmm. So I go there and, you know, I'm having the same, you know, questions about, you know, all the theology, all those questions in my mind.
Yeah.
And no professors are really able to answer my questions besides like, you know, I remember we read a whole book about how all the different aspects of evolution, like were all falsifications, and like all of the truths of the Bible, like the 7-day literal creation were all proven correct. And I was like, so how is it that like the establishments, like doctors, scientists, astronomers, like are they all just like secretly meeting to discuss what lies they're going to believe? Like, this seems like obvious information. Why is no one? And the professors were just like, I don't know. I guess they just don't want to see the truth. So I was like, it was a very big problem for me, like yeah. having to believe that the Bible was the only thing that I could look at for mm-hmm. information, and that I had to just say all the science, any other text that claims to have any impact on how I understand God, like, is irrelevant. You have to just be between you and the Bible, the Holy Spirit. And I found it interesting that the Holy Spirit spoke so differently to some people. Like,
right.
you had to be water immersion for baptism for these people. This group said you could only be sprinkled, and it's free will here, and it's predestination there. And I was like, well, the Holy Spirit seems to be, like, schizophrenic, or most people are just lying, and, like, thank God you're a part of this one little sliver of Christianity that gets it right. Like, yeah. So it was starting to, again, you know, these are all questions that were starting to percolate.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break there.
Yep.
Right. And we'll come back and pick up where we left off and hear how those questions blossomed and bloomed and what you did with them.
Sweet.
We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Rebecca's story. Before we come back, I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org and click stories, you'll find a whole archive of conversion stories from every conceivable background. Men, women, clergy people, lay people, Christians, non-Christians, everything is there. You're likely to find a story that really speaks to your journey or someone in your life that you'd like to invite to consider Christianity in the Catholic Church. Check that out at chnetwork.org and click stories. But again, we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Rebecca's story, so stay tuned. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Rebecca Cohen Morris. She's a former evangelical Protestant, as well as all kinds of things, right? It's been a circuitous journey so far from your background. But when we left off, Rebecca, you're at Southeastern
yep.
College, right?
Yep.
University there. And having lots of theological questions, wrestling with evolution, but also really just kind of this question of how does faith interface with reason, right? And
yes.
of course, one of the issues there is not so much the answers themselves, but the fact that there's just not a conversation here,
right?
And that was one of the things you were wrestling with, but lots of questions were coming up. So let's pick it up there. What happened with all those questions you were asking?
Well, I wish I had like met, so growing up in the South, you know that Catholics aren't really Christian. Mm-hmm. Like they pray to Mary, they pray to saints. You know, like you go into their services, there's no coffee, there's no like good bands playing, like the homilies are 5 minutes. You're like, just growing up in the South, it was like, man, we're praying for those Catholics. Mm-hmm. You know, when Mother Teresa died, I was like, oh, it's so sad that she's not going to make it to heaven because she's Catholic. Mm. And I was just, so I just didn't have a concept of, I wish I'd known about the Catholic Church. Yeah. I wish I'd known that there was a thing called the Catechism, because that would have been a, you know, pretty helpful to have come across. But instead I was just left kind of wrestling with my own questions. And, a lot of, so I understand that the college wanted to create this experience for students to have an alternative college experience where they were kind of guarding what they allowed at their school. So I do understand that's what they were trying to do. But what ended up happening for me, at least when I was going through college, was I felt that I was seeing the college come down really hard on kids that were making mistakes. So if you broke curfew, you had fines. I remember my brother came to visit me, and I was like, well, curfew's at 1. I really want to talk to him because he came from Atlanta, you know, Southeastern's in Lakeland, Florida. And I was like, well, I guess we could just sit in the car and talk and hope that the security guy doesn't come around. And I remember like laying the seats back and being like, oh, hope he doesn't see us, and then having to sprint onto campus and like get to my dorm before, you know, I could get caught. you know, and I'm like, yeah. I understand those rules were good, but you know, going out dancing, I felt like I was just such a renegade, you know, just I found myself sneaking around and being like, a lot of these rules are stupid. Like, I'm not doing anything wrong. Obviously, like getting myself into situations where, yeah, I understand why they said you shouldn't go out drinking and dancing and going to parties, because, yeah, I would end up making mistakes. And, you know, a lot of the kids who were doing the same stuff, if someone else was out with them, if they felt convicted, they would go report you to the judicial review board. And if you could get 2 other people to say they saw you doing something like drinking or dancing or smoking or, you know, doing something that was against the school rules, then they could kick you off the sports team.
Wait a minute. How did you see me doing that? Where were you?
I know. I'm like, weren't you? You were just in the corner praying, I guess. Yeah. So I was just, I watched friends get in trouble and then get suspended. My friend was on the beach and she had like a piece of fruit that someone had soaked in rum. Some person on the beach had offered her a piece of fruit. Now, obviously, like maybe we should have learned from like early Bible stories, like don't take fruit from a, you know, well, I guess he knew Eve. So, but yeah, so she had it. Someone was like, oh, that had rum in it. I feel convicted. Reported it. She got suspended. She was a senior, a theology major. She hadn't been doing anything wrong in school. And she almost like missed all her finals. And, wow. You know, she was, so I had this sense of like justice. Like I was mad for myself when like I would be bullied. And, you know, I was like, well, one day if I ever get pretty enough where anyone's ever even going to talk to me, like I'm never going to treat anyone bad, like the way that I feel I've been treated. And I would see other people get treated wrongly or what I felt was unjust. And so it made me really upset. A girl on my team, I think this was probably one of the most problematic experiences I had with college. And I don't think there was like any one thing that made me, you know, throw in the towel on Christianity. But she was a girl on our team. She was struggling with her sexuality, and she was a lesbian. Someone reported her to the school. She got kicked off the team and got kicked out of the school. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to them because I was friends with the deans and, you know, a lot of them from coaching basketball and all that came to our games. And so I was talking to them and I was like, it doesn't make sense. Like she needs help. Why would the church, like, why would the college kick her out? You know, when someone needs a doctor, like we, you know, the sick need a doctor, like, right. Why are we pushing her away? And their response was, we're not the church. This is a college. You know, these parents are paying money for their kids to be at school. And I was like, this isn't the church. Like, is this how we're going to treat people? Like, is this what I'm dedicating my life to? And then, yeah, again, all those theological questions. I was like, you know,
yeah.
I don't even think I like this. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe I've just been duped.
Yeah.
During that same time, I was playing college basketball. I tore my ACL in Kentucky in the snow. It was during the game. But I remember it was in the snow because I was trying to get around in the snow to get back to the bus and couldn't really walk. I also like cracked my femur in that same incident. So I was like, you know, basketball's over for me. My coach let me coach some practices while he was teaching. So I got to be officially like an assistant basketball coach for a college team. And around that same time, all of that's happening, my parents were like, we're doing really bad financially. Mm. We're not going to be able to help you with school. And I was like, I remember going home and opening all the envelopes. And I was like, well, first, there's $10,000 of late fees. And like, this is a lot of money. And it really like hit me finally at like 21. I'm like, I'm not going to be able to pay this off very quickly. So I was like, you know, I'm just going to graduate early. I took 18 hours of classes. I graduated in 2008 with the English degree. And I was like, you know, I never got to go overseas. I'm going to have to come back and pay all these loans. I wonder if they'll pay me to live overseas. So I was 21. I went on to greatopair.com and, you know, found a family that was like, yeah, we seem normal. And I was like, hadn't seen the movie Taken yet. So I was like, this couldn't end bad. Like, I'll just go to Europe and get paid to be an au pair and have free accommodations and, you know, get to live a little. Like, I'm done with Christian college. When I come back to reality, I'll come and, you know, pay off these student loans and figure out what I'm doing with my life. But I have no idea what's going to happen. And I my parents were trying their best. But like me and my, you know, immaturity and, you know, just where I was at, like spiritually, I was so angry at them. Like, if I was fine if we just never talked again. And we had had, our own challenges growing up. So I was just very hurt. I felt hurt by the church, the way that they had treated people. I had felt hurt by the church because some of them in the church growing up knew some of the stuff I was going through and didn't do anything. And I was like, I just am sick of trying to be good all the time. Maybe it's all a lie. Like, just like the 6-day literal creation thing is probably a lie. Like, maybe these rules about how to live are also a lie. So with that great mentality in mind, I took off for Munich, Germany. And I was like, you know, I don't know who's picking me up from the airport, but this really nice guy who looked like the picture of the father, he picks me up. So I end up with a family I think I'm going to end up with that I met online, like literally on Skype. Hello, I'm going to come move here. You know, I sell my car, sell everything, and I just move off to Germany at 21. So while I'm there, I'm like, you know, Europe's pretty awesome. And at this point, I think I'd kind of just, no one believed anything there. None of the people I was with believed in God. They were like, I remember very clearly one of the ladies I was with, she's like, you know, people believe Mickey Mouse is real, but like no one, like people go to Disney World, but no one really thinks that all that stuff's real. So I was just like, yeah, that's a really good point. So I'm just really lost and doing all the things that I tried not to do for so long. And it was a very sad, sad time. I remember reading a lot of Nietzsche and Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, and I was like, where have these people been all my life? this makes sense. You know, like, there's really just nothing. And, like, who am I to tell you what your truth is? Like, you know, if you want to live that way, that's your business. And I did remember thinking, like, you know, that quote, you know, where Nietzsche says that God is dead, we have killed him. I was sad because I was like, I liked the idea that I had of God, like as a kid, like that 12-year-old experience where I felt like he said my life was worth something. But that was just all fake. You know, I just conjured that up myself. And so I, you know, go through my time in Germany. It ends up being a really crazy experience as an au pair. And I end up getting two hours to get out of the house when I told. So the woman that I worked for, she would tell me to do something and I would do it. And then she'd say, I never told you to do that. Or she'd be like, okay, now that you live here, what kind of food do you want? And I was like, I don't really, well, I'll just eat whatever y'all eat. Like, it doesn't matter. She's like, no, tell me what you want. This is just to give you an example so that you, lest you think that maybe I just got kicked out of the house. But I was like, yeah, I'll just eat whatever. She buys me a bunch of like chicken salad and, you know, whatever. So the next day I'm cooking it during lunch and she's like, why are you making your own food? Is my food not good enough for you? And I'm like, you bought it for me and said to, okay. She's like, why are Americans so wasteful? Like they're just wasting energy in the middle of the day using the stove. And I'm like, okay, you know, so I didn't do that again. The next day, I obviously did not cook my lunch. She's like, oh, you're just letting all the food go to waste. And I was like, I don't know what you want from me. So it was situations like that. Sure. After 5 months, I was like, you know, I don't think I'm meeting your expectations. I'll stay as long as you need till you find a replacement au pair. But I don't know that this is working out. And she's like, okay, well, you can be out in 2 hours. Wow. And like, I lived at the house.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm like basically homeless in the snow.
Yeah.
Working, trying to figure out where to go. So I end up coming back to the U.S. after spending a month traveling around. And I mentioned all of that to explain how I ended up in Barcelona during that month after I'd, you know, gotten the 2-hour notice that I needed to leave. I was staying in a co-ed hostel. And this was probably my first experience with Catholicism. I mean, I'd known one kid who was Catholic and he still, you know, he prayed. And I was like, you know, he seems like he probably believes in Jesus, but I don't know if he said the sinner's prayer. But so I was like, yeah. That was my one experience with sure. Catholics. but I saw this huge church on this mountain that's overlooking the city of Barcelona and then the Mediterranean Sea. And I was like, I think I'm just going to go walk up to that church. It looks really pretty. So I didn't realize it was that far. And I'm in like flip-flops and a white dress. And I just start walking. It takes me about 6 hours. At a certain point, as I'm about to get up to the top, I realize that I'm like hanging onto roots, like climbing up this mountain. I don't have a cell phone. No one in the world literally knows where I am. And I'm like looking down. I'm like, I'm about to fall to my death. I emerge from the bushes into the street. I finally made it up. And they like see this like wild woman come out of the bushes. And I'm like, here I am. And I hear these monks singing in the church. And I was like, I walked in and it was angelic. And I had my journal because, you know, I was an English major. So I was working on the great Ernest Hemingway novel that I was going to write one day. But I remember being up there, hearing the monks singing, seeing the church and the icons and looking out over the whole city of Barcelona, seeing the Mediterranean Sea and just writing about the beauty of it. And I was like, wish that was real, but it sure is beautiful. And so that was a really cool moment for me.
Yeah.
Also seeing the Sagrada Familia. So I was like, okay, they've been working on this since the 1800s. Like, why would anyone build anything for that long?
Yeah.
And all the energy that they were putting into it, I was just like, it's just baffling. So I come back to the U.S. After all of that, and I'm just like, that was cool, you know, Europe, back to real life. So I start teaching because I was like, I'm going to figure out a way to go back to Barcelona so I can maybe get a job over there. So I'll teach for a couple years, save up money, because I was like, what else can I do with an English degree? Teach. So, and I got a job coaching basketball at a huge high school. So I was 22 doing that, teaching seniors and sophomores. Most of the kids were close to my age. And it was a pretty rough school. Most of the kids were undocumented. Most of their parents were undocumented. And the stories of families escaping cartels and mm-hmm. saying, like, I didn't have time to get papers. Like, we swam across the Rio in the middle of the night. You know, had babies on my back. You know, I was like, this is, yeah. That's insane. And I was like, yeah. Why aren't you working hard at school? And they're like, I don't have papers. I can't go to college. Like, I literally can't do anything. I have no idea what I'm going to do with my life. And so I started to, even with this like idea that God was dead and the distant memory of the Catholic churches, I was like, I'm just going to throw myself into working with these kids. I'm still living a very stupid life outside of school at this time. And it's during that stupid part of my life where I end up getting like 3 tickets from like car stuff, speeding, just being an idiot. I don't know how I functioned. I would work till, you know, 10 at night coaching basketball and be up teaching at 7 a.m. And so I meet my husband at a bar that summer. And my husband, he's like, I just graduated from Notre Dame Law and I became a Catholic. And I'm like, cool. I bet you didn't graduate from Notre Dame Law because I've never met someone who went to Notre Dame. So that would be impossible. And no lawyer ever, I've never met a lawyer, you know, I think a cousin's a lawyer. And I was like, and also guys like him never talk to me. So whatever. I tried to like just dance with him and he like turns me around. He's like, I just want to talk to you. And I was like, well, that's weird. No one ever wants to talk at a bar. And he's just like, wow, you like teach and you seem to care about these kids. And I'm like, don't get it confused. Like, I'm a very, very broken person. I am not a good person. You seem like you have all your stuff together. Like, you need to like stay away. But he really liked me. So he calls me, we go out. I light my hair on fire on our first date. I just like lean in a candle and he's like putting my hair out and he holds my hand as we leave the restaurant. And I was like, wow, it's really serious. Like a first date and you're holding my hand. And then he asked me to marry him like 6 months later. And I'm like, well, you're kind of Catholic, but we kind of go to this Protestant church. I don't believe in anything, so I don't care what we do. I'm like, are we getting married in the church? He's like, no, I just don't think you're ready for that. And I'm like, I really don't care. If you want to be a Mormon, I'll be a Mormon. You want to be an atheist, I'll be an atheist. You want to be Catholic, I'll be Catholic. I like you, and, you know, let's just, you know. So we end up getting married in a Protestant church. He and I don't get married in the church, and we embark on the next few years that would end up being. I've been married 15 years and he is amazing, and he is the reason that like I found Jesus.
Praise God.
But those first few years were, now if you can just imagine, two very selfish people who my husband had just become Catholic, and you know, we both had a lot of baggage. God had a lot of stuff to work out. And I still had all my doubts, and I was like, I don't know why you believe any of this stuff.
What was the turning point there? We've got about 8 minutes left.
Okay. Gosh.
You have so many good stories. It's hard to pack it all into an interview.
It's hard. So he was just like, you know, you don't give yourself enough credit. Like, you can think through some of this stuff. You know, we're in Protestant church, and he was like, you can't just like go through life saying like, oh, we can't figure it out, we can't know anything. So I just wanted to understand better, and he really encouraged me to dive deeper into stuff. And so we were going to church. A lot of our friends, you know, we have our two kids, and they're the best part of my life. They people start leaving the church because they're deconstructing their faith, and they just are like, you know, like, it seems really close-minded. We're part of this church that teaches these negative things. Like, we need to be affirming all of this. And so I realized like I had some really tough questions to answer, because I was, you know, working with my students. I was doing immigration work with them. I was teaching high school. I was blogging. I started running for office. I won city council. I realized I was doing a lot of work with Spanish speakers. I'd become fluent by then. And I was like, you know, I guess I need to go to law school now, because we're trying to find attorneys for these kids and their housing issues. And I find myself like doing all this activism with like immigration, housing, education, and all the people on both sides of me are like, and now we go to the LGBTQ rallies, and now we go to Pride, and you're pro-choice, obviously, right? And I was like, I had to like decide, what do I actually believe? And I couldn't find a church that had a solid reason for believing anything, because all the churches that, you know, were starting to change their doctrines. And I was like, is there any church that doesn't just change their doctrine when it becomes unpopular? Like, I'll be happy to be in, you know, an affirming church, but like, show me why, like, God all of a sudden has changed his mind. Or, so we start, we'd come home from church and we'd start listening to Bishop Barron and reading the catechism. And we're like, man, that's a really good explanation for that. Oh, that's a really great explanation for that. And we were like, you know, we just should go find a church, like a Catholic church. And my husband's like, yeah, it's probably about time. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, maybe I'll just become Catholic at this point, because it seems like either we're going to be Catholic or we're going to be nothing, because like the churches we're at are just falling apart. People are leaving. I'm finding it more difficult to defend to my friends who are doing activism, like why I believe what I believe. So either like I needed to figure out, and the Catholic Church just kept having all the best answers. And so I start RCI in 2019, during that same time period where I literally am like doing all the running for office, studying for LSAT, teaching, running a nonprofit. And then COVID hits and I'm on the city council. And so we're having weekly executive session meetings. I'm doing Zoom RCIA, and just God just is really doing some incredible things in my heart. Mm-hmm. Our marriage, we had to get it convalidated. So we got to have our wedding again, which was beautiful because we'd had such a rough go at it for the first half of our marriage. And just having the sacraments, like my husband became a different person. I became a different person. And I realized like, and this is kind of how we ended up in Steubenville, where it was just very like, how do we live our lives like Catholics now? We need to find a church that's vibrant. Like, are there any kids? No, none of the churches we were at that were Catholic in Atlanta. So we started looking all over the country and we were like, you know, all of the, like, we're both, my husband and I are both attorneys. And we were just like, you know, just why gain the whole world and lose your soul? Like, we are working and we're never seeing our kids. We're going to have to keep working harder. We're never going to have like a Catholic community that we can spend time with because we're working too hard, like law firms and stuff. So I resigned from city council. He quit his job. I kept flying back and forth to finish my last year of law school from Steubenville to Atlanta. And we just gave up everything and moved here so that our kids could have, we said, you know, our life has been ordered as like our careers, nice house and nice neighborhood, God, kids. And we were like, we're just reordering it. It's going to be God. Where can we grow spiritually? In the Catholic Church, in Steubenville. You know, for us, that's what it was. And where can our kids grow in their faith? And, you know, I guess like the last thing, like that was very important. My husband thought, he was working with some Knights of Columbus at the church during 2020 when I came into the church. And they were all there building a wheelchair ramp for someone. And he looked around and saw no one his age. And he was like, who's going to be there to build my wheelchair ramp? And so we just really realized, like, it sounds silly, but it was like, we need to be at a church where people, like, are passionate about the Lord, that are raising their kids, that actually have kids, that are our age. And so moving here to Steubenville, it was obviously, it wasn't that it was Steubenville. It was that we had that choice where God said, like, are you going to give everything up? Mm-hmm. And, like, what are you willing to do for your faith?
Yeah.
And so making that choice was, like, the most life-giving decision, you know, joining the church 5 years ago. And now I work at AIM Women's Center and do pro-life advocacy and work with pregnant women. We started a maternity home, had our first mom move in yesterday.
Wow.
And so I just took a lot of the energy that I was focusing, like my activism work, and where we live, pregnant women who are experiencing homelessness are the most vulnerable. So just as I'd always wanted to work on a mission field, it might not be in India, but like in the church with a whole team of the church, like around the work that we do, you know, I'm not out there on my own doing my own activism stuff or with a different group of people who I'm not aligned with. You know, here at AIM Women's Center, like I have a lot of the Catholic churches, a lot of the Protestant churches, but it's very focused, and my work means something and I'm able to align it with my faith in a very clear way, like, because I'm doing this for the Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've been looking for that for so long. There's, you know, there's such a connection between having a firm teaching authority to know what's true, to then guide, again, the practical side of how do we serve? How do we love? Because if it becomes just a matter of our own interpretation, we don't know how to serve people. We don't know how to help them and care for them. We need to know what kind of beings these people are. What's their destiny? What's their purpose? And so there's those questions are always so unified.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I feel like the work I was doing, again, with like the undocumented, the immigrant, the poor, that was an outpouring of my faith. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would still be doing that, you know, shoulder to shoulder with other Catholics. But in Steubenville, there isn't that same population. So I definitely don't want people to think that I shifted from one to pro-life, because I was always like, well, there's a lot of people doing pro-life stuff. Like, why me? I'm not equipped to do that. Like, I speak Spanish. I work with, you know, that's just not what I do. But here has been working to save unborn children's lives and to help women become the fullest expression of themselves as a mother is such a unifying like idea of like how, like what the church teaches about the value of life and womanhood and motherhood. And so, you know, it's just, it's such a testimony. Like anytime you explain like why you're doing what you're doing, mm-hmm. It's very clear. And like in our area, that's the group of people that have been forgotten.
Yeah.
And that's who God's always called me to serve. And,
and you're able to pass on that word you received from the Lord that I have a purpose for you. I have a plan for you. Just hold on.
Right? Yep. Yeah. He's always faithful. It's incredible. God's always faithful.
Well, I know you have a thousand other stories you keep telling. Sorry we have to cut it off here, but thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for your work. We'll be praying for you. Keep it up.
I appreciate that.
Well, thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Rebecca's story is an inspiration to you. As always, remember that we remain on the journey. And as Rebecca shared with us, God gives each of us that word, that He has a plan and a purpose for you. Just hold on. Keep praying. Carry on. We'll see you again next week with another story. In the meantime, God bless.